Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now is Dr. Eugene Roemer, the director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a former national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. Eugene, it's always an honor and pleasure having you on. Thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our coverage of air and missile defense on this, the 10th anniversary of the company's Iron Dome missile and rocket and mortar defense system. Eugene, it's certainly an extraordinary time. Obviously, we have a new administration in Washington led by a president who has vowed to be tougher on Russia, calling Vladimir Putin a killer, a pronouncement that the Kremlin didn't like, which I think is a little bit absurd given how hard Putin has worked to develop that brand, as I've joked with others. Putin is increasingly less popular at home, as Alex Navalny has raised pressure on the regime after failing to poison him. The opposition leader was jailed after returning to Russia from Germany, where he was treated. Putin is cracking down on internal dissent. He also massed an enormous number of troops on the Ukrainian border, making it abundantly clear to anybody who was paying attention that there was no way to stop him, for example, if he wanted to march on Kiev. There is a sense by some in Washington, Eugene, that somehow it was the administration's rhetoric and the rhetoric that the administration organized from its allies and partners that drove this change. But Vladimir Putin has a tendency of using these efforts to actually underscore his power rather than the effectiveness of threats. What drove his actions and what drove him to step down? And did it have anything to do with what anybody in Washington had to say about it?
Again, thanks for having me. I wouldn't necessarily say that it was the administration's rhetoric, or let alone the reference to him as a killer, that is the cause of this. Obviously, the relationship has been very difficult for a long time. As everyone says, it's at its lowest point since probably before the Cold War. But I think the administration took over the foreign policy portfolio with this idea that Russia is not going to be near the top of its agenda. And Putin, I think, made it abundantly clear with the deployment of troops to the Ukrainian border and the very obvious threat to reinvade the country that he's not going to be sitting back idly, and that he will have a say in the way the U.S.-Russian agenda is shaped. So I would say that this strategic exercise that we witnessed over a period of a few weeks, and I would say that it was a strategic exercise, was intended for three principal audiences. The first audience, of course, was in Washington, and it was a message to new president, America's new president, President Biden, that you don't set the agenda and cherry pick what issues matter in this relationship and which ones do not. So you can't just engage with us on strategic stability and put other issues aside. I will smack Ukraine as hard as I want to, and what are you going to do about it? And the second message was for Kyiv that I will set the agenda for Russian-Ukrainian relations too. You're not going to cherry pick from the Minsk agenda, which is sort of the broad framework for negotiating the relationship was settling the conflict in eastern Ukraine, rather. So I will show you what I can do. It's very obvious that you cannot stand up to me militarily. And I will also try to provoke you. And if you do something stupid along the lines of what Georgia's President Saakashvili did in 2008, I will hit you hard and Biden will not help you. And then, of course, there was a domestic dimension. As you said, Putin is becoming less popular. And he has deployed the tried and true card of, you know, being surrounded by enemies on all fronts, and that he, one of the few global leaders who can manage this very difficult global situation, can stand up for Russian interests and manage the relationship both with enemies near in Ukraine and far in Washington. So that, in a nutshell, I think is what was the real intent behind the events that we witnessed in the past few weeks.
How vulnerable, Eugene, is Putin, right? I mean, he's about 27% popularity. Navalny is less than that, right? I mean, as you've said, the massive geography of Russia works against opposition movements because it's very hard to communicate, especially as Putin clamps down. How vulnerable is Putin, and what is he doing to crack down on the opposition? And ironically, whenever authoritarians do this, it also over time has a tendency to backfire on them, right? Because there are already claims that he's being a little neo-Stalinist now, because Russia has had a lot more freedom for its opposition than I think many people have recognized over the decades. How vulnerable is he? What is he doing to crack down? And does it become more or less problematic for him over time?
Well, I don't believe that he is vulnerable in the sense that somebody will replace him anytime soon or for the foreseeable future. You're right in that his popularity has been declining, but he's still the most popular politician in Russia. He controls a massive propaganda apparatus. He controls a massive law enforcement apparatus that reports to him, and from what we can tell, is still very much loyal to him. And then he controls the policymaking process, the legislative process that has become ever more oppressive with new pieces of legislation being passed to prohibit just about every form of political activity in the country, so much so that at present, probably the only form of political activity that is still allowed and not punishable by law is voting. But any kind of display of protest, even those that are nominally allowed by current legislation, are being punished and punished fiercely. And I think, as you and I discussed previously, the regime has been quite adept at deploying new technologies in pursuit of its anti-democratic objectives. So, for example, Moscow authorities have been relying on facial recognition software. Moscow is blanketed with cameras to go after people selectively. Of course, you can't arrest everyone who participates in protests, but if you do so selectively, it really scares many others and sends a message that you're vulnerable. And you may be not vulnerable today for something you did yesterday, but they may come back to you, knock on your door sometime, you know, 2 weeks from now or a month from now. And that, I believe, has a very significant impact on suppressing domestic dissent. They're about to declare Navalny's organization, his anti-corruption foundation, basically an extremist organization, which would put it on the par with ISIS in Russia. So I think the regime is quite strong, unfortunately, from my point of view.
It is very unfortunate. And I was going to point out when we spoke before this interview, you mentioned that, pretty soon to get on the Moscow metro, it's going to be with facial recognition being sold as, look, it's going to be so much easier for you to get on the metro, as opposed to it's going to be so much easier for us to track you no matter where you go in the capital region.
Right, exactly. And, as the authorities discover that they still have left some, there's still some holes that are unplugged in that massive dam against domestic protest, they find legislative ways to plug those holes.
Obviously, there's internet legislation also that's on the books that will make communication a little bit harder.
Absolutely.
As Putin becomes more vulnerable, how much more dangerous does he get, do you think, Eugene? Because authoritarians have a tendency of acting out, especially outside their borders, when they come under sharp pressure. And it looks like this administration is going to be coming under pressure, whether from at home or from abroad.
Look, I think if what you are possibly suggesting is he's going to invade another country, or is he going to do another Ukraine somewhere in one of the former Soviet states? I don't think so. I think that the situation in Ukraine in 2013 and 14 and the Russian reaction to it, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, let's be blunt about it, was a product of that particular dynamic. So it's not like something that was done by the Kremlin in order to just distract from domestic political troubles. If you remember, the protests in Ukraine were occurring at the same time as Putin was celebrating the 2014 Winter Olympics in Russia. That was supposed to be a great accomplishment of the dear leader. And those protests were not at all something that he really wanted to focus on at the time. So I think if there is another situation like Ukraine, unfortunately, it will be a product, as I see it, of a specific circumstance. And here, you know, I'm afraid that, you know, Putin could overreact in, let's say, a situation in Belarus that has witnessed unprecedented public protests against the stolen election of August 2020. So if those protests resume on a large scale once again, I could imagine that the Kremlin will feel compelled to intervene so as to preserve the place of Belarus in Russia's orbit. And don't forget that Belarus, for example, was it's uniquely positioned vis-a-vis Russia because they have some strange construct which says that the two countries are part of the same state.
Right.
They have some kind of a union treaty.
And the Russians have already spread enough disinformation that Western intelligence services or American intelligence services were targeting Lukashenko for assassination, which Putin raised in his call with Biden, you know, as if, you know, it wasn't a complete whole cloth fabrication from the Russian side.
Absolutely. And, you know, that continues. Putin's security chief, Patrushev, just spoke to his Belarusian counterpart and offered help.
I have to say, I mean, you have to admire, even if you may loathe what he's doing and how he's doing it, you have to admire, you know, the old Soviet playbook can be very, very relevant today.
Yes.
And certainly how he uses it. The debate in Washington, Eugene, you know, even when you were over at the White House was, you know, the fine line between what's appeasement and what's actually realism. You know, as you've pointed out, you know, everybody thinks of Germany as Europe's largest nation. It's actually Russia by an order of magnitude. It doesn't matter what sanctions it's under. It has abundant natural resources, agricultural resources. It can feed its population. It's created its own ecosystem in which it lives. It's not really that dependent on, you know, sanctions that are imposed on it. And anytime that folks talk about engagement, you know, people shout appeasement, you know, anytime anything happens. I don't want to bring Matt Rojansky into this, but I mean, there's a sense, oh my God, you know, there's appeasement is happening as opposed to maybe strategic realism. The question is this administration on the right track in terms of the sanctions it's trying to impose, whether to punish for SolarWinds or the 2016 or the 2020 election interference? What's the right approach, given we have a new administration trying to show that there's a new sheriff in town, but also say, you know, but also an administration that's saying, look, I mean, there are big issues and we're willing to work with you on them. What's the balance? Are they on the right track? Are they doing the right things? Do they need to be doing different things?
My sense, and perhaps it's to some extent wishful thinking on my part, that the administration actually is doing quite well. I think the decision early on to extend the New START treaty for 5 more years was exactly the right one. I don't see this administration as really being eager to impose a whole set of new sanctions. I think they will, as I believe the president said, respond to Russian transgressions at a time and place in a mode of their choosing, which I think is also right. I think it's also a fact that significant future actors in this administration are still not in place, that the foreign policy and national security team is still being fleshed out. So there's still some ways to go. But I think if you look back at the record of the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, and the Obama administration, I'm going to leave the Trump administration aside. I think there's always been this temptation to fix the relationship and put it on a sustainable basis and once and for all so we can live happily thereafter. And I think in this administration, based on what I've seen so far, there's no desire to, you know, fix it and make it good. And I agree with the underlying proposition that perhaps this relationship is not really fixable for the foreseeable future. And what we need to do is manage it with skill, with patience, and firmness. And that's something that I think is a very realistic, well, I would say both realist and realistic approach to manage it, because I don't see in a foreseeable future any possibility of this relationship becoming better. We're going to need the Russians on some issues. Iran, for example, they have to be a party to that. And on others, you know, we'll just manage it and kind of come as it, deal with it as it comes.
Russia and China have always had a fraught relationship. During the Cold War, Stalin and Mao hated each other. And then Mao made a deal with Nixon that turned that border adversarial and tied down 50 divisions, I think, which people don't have a tendency of remembering throughout the Cold War, right? So as much as we were bankrupting them, China was helping bankrupt the former Soviet Union as well. These two powers, as well as Iran and North Korea and many others, are finding common cause in their hatred of the United States and its allies and its rules-based order. Admiral Jim Stavridis wrote about it in his book, along with Nate Ackerman, you know, in 2035, about what becomes a world war and how these powers all collude to help China against the United States, ultimately. You know, the late, great Peter Rodman always used to point out, we have to do whatever we can to keep these two separated. Although the question is, well, how on earth do you keep them separated, right? Eugene, how do we need to think about this not as two separate challenges, because there are some strategists who say Russia doesn't matter and we have to focus 100% on China. How do we deal with them in a conjoined way? And is there any way to keep them apart if they want to work together against us, which they have throughout the Cold War, you know, even if we were friendly with one side or another?
Look, I think that, you know, there is this argument you sometimes hear in Washington that we need to split them up and bring Russia over to our side. I think that's an unrealistic proposition that ignores the fact that Russian policy toward China, Russian embrace of China, especially on Putin's watch over the past 20 years, is a product of, you know, very powerful domestic factors. And in order for us to sort of split them up, you know, A, we need to realize and change the way we've been going about promoting democracy all over the world, which, well, I'm exaggerating, but still, we need to give up sort of major elements of our foreign policy agenda, which actually this administration has embraced as its priority, and basically close our eyes to the domestic developments in both China and in Russia, and leave them to manage their, what they basically claim to be their spheres of influence on their own. Now, there is a structural problem with our relationship with Russia and our relationship with China, as those two countries increasingly kind of look at our presence in their front, in their respective front yards as hostile and intolerable from the standpoint of their interests. We are now in Russia's front yard within probably, 2 hours driving distance from St. Petersburg after we expanded NATO. And, you know, we have this hot relationship with Taiwan. So we're locked into these two relationships. And the only way forward, as I see it, is to manage these very precarious situations, but I don't see how we honestly can solve them. As to splitting the two, I'm very pessimistic about the possibility of it. If you look at Russian-Chinese relations, there's a great deal of complementarity between the two countries' economies. One is a manufacturing powerhouse, the other is immensely rich in natural resources. They have complementary political systems, and their principal sort of kind of interests and concerns, geopolitically speaking, are in two very different theaters. Russia is in Europe, and China is in Asia. So for China, it's the Asia-Pacific theater that is really most important. For Russia, it's Europe. They don't overlap, but they complement each other. And I think we need to have two coordinated, but not overlapping strategies necessarily to manage those two relationships.
That is once again, Eugene, right? I mean, you're strategically realistic. If China wants to do something within its borders, much like Russia wants to do stuff within its borders, there are limits to what the international community will be willing to do, right? I mean, there are things we could do. It's not abundantly clear we're willing to do them. What are some of the things that we need to be willing to do if we want to move a needle with Russia? What's the needle mover with Putin? Because Putin has some very competent civil servants, both on the economic front, on the security front, who've managed to insulate themselves as best as a big country like that can from the very sort of economic weapons we would want to turn on them. It's not abundantly clear how much really Nord Stream means at the end of the day, right? I mean, it's gained a lot of political
baggage.
Capital has been baggage, maybe has been invested in it. What's the right way to move the Russia needle? Because Russia is a nation that does respond to force. It adapts well to force applied to it, but it also can respond to force. What's the right pressure that needs to be applied as the administration tries to set this new tone?
Well, I think we're already doing this. We have been doing some of this since the invasion of Crimea in 2014. We are rebuilding the military capabilities of the alliance. We've put in place a number of sanctions which don't necessarily take effect in terms of inflicting pain on Russia in the near term, but over time they will matter. I would also add to this that Russia or the Russian government is doing a lot of damage to the Russian economy on its own without our help. The preoccupation, the massive investment, for example, that's going into perpetuating Russia's position as a petrostate at a time when, for example, Europe and the United States are looking for ways to decarbonize their economies. And the great energy transition looms on the horizon. Russia is making investments with a time horizon of 20, 30, 40 years. I don't know how long pipelines last. Pipelines built in the Soviet era in the 1980s are still pumping gas and oil to Europe. So, I've taken a different view of Nord Stream, for example, and I've argued that imposing sanctions to prevent Nord Stream from being completed is a counterproductive move, because with Nord Stream, Russia will be locked into pumping gas into Europe for decades to come, at a time when Europe, the buyer rather than the seller, will be in a driver's seat determining the price of the commodity in a marketplace that's become increasingly competitive over the past 10 or more years or so. So, I think, this is a situation where strategic patience is warranted, and you really have to, I apologize for saying things that are obvious, but I don't have a better answer than to go back to the writings of George Kennan in the late 40s and early 50s, when he analyzed the situation with the Soviet Union and argued for a policy of kind of strategic patience, restraint, and taking the long view. I don't know what else to say in this situation.
Eugene, it's always a pleasure having you on the program. It's always a treat. All the best to you. Thanks very much. Already looking forward to welcoming you back on again in the future. Thanks so much.
Again, good to be with you. Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.